Introduction to Chapters 9, 10, and 11. So my dear old mother, born in 1909, struggled to liberate herself from the then-dying constraints of the Victorian era. She wanted to be progressive, so she read Dr. Spock. Her parents were provincial conservatives from Idaho. Raising her only child in Berkeley during the post-Depression era was a challenge. As I grew away from the values that she was raised with, it created a lot of tension at home. I entered college in 1957 as a virginal Christian Republican, VCR, reflecting my parents' religion and politics. In a few short years, all of that changed. In these three chapters, I'll share my journey from going from a VCR to an EAL, an experienced atheist liberal. I suspect that many of you made a similar journey. As you can imagine, it created some real family friction, to say the least. Chapter 9, Sex.
Hey, Gilbert, tell us, are you a virgin?
Reviewing my own sexual development, my life seems to have evolved in three phases. Phase 1 was from infancy through roughly the end of college. Phase 2 encompasses the time of my adult years until I started a family. Phase 3 was from then until about now. During these years, the country was also evolving sexually. Here's how I described all of this in a recent one-man show in front of a live audience.
So I got started on sex pretty early because my mother had read Dr. Spock. Did any of your parents read Dr. Spock? Okay. And he wanted to be forward-thinking, you know, liberal and all of that. So my mother told me how babies are made before I even asked about it. And I remember she said, it was so strange, she said, well, the woman lays down like this and the man lays on top of her. God, does that sound strange? What, wouldn't he squash her? You know, she'd suffocate or something? I mean, why would you do that? And if that wasn't enough, then pretty soon there was something about a penis. I thought, this is really getting bizarre. And I said, you and Dad never did anything like that, right? No. So I have a little pup tent. I have a backyard, and I have a neighborhood girl next door. Her name was Eunice. She was a year older than me. I was 6, she was 7. And so I was telling Eunice about what my mother had told me. And Eunice says, really? How strange. And then she grabbed my arm, and she said, let's try it. And she drags me into this little tent. I had this little tent in the backyard, and she lays down on her back. So I got on top of her. You okay? What? Nothing was happening. It was so strange. I said, nothing's happening here. I wonder how long this takes. And I found out later it's about 10 more years is what that takes. Well, so then, fast forward, I'm now 11. And I'm speaking for many of the men here. They probably haven't ever admitted this. But at 11 years old, I was aware of the fact that men used to like to look at women's butts. I knew that. I'd see men do it. We talked about it. But I never saw, what would you do that for? I mean, that seemed to be really kind of stupid. And then at 11 and 6 months, that all changed. And pretty soon, I was looking at women's butts. And I thought, what is happening with that? How weird is that? It happened just like that. And nobody told me to do it. Well, in preparation for this show, I found some research that explains all of this. There's a team at the Johns Hopkins Medical School who studies hormones. And they have come up with this hormone, heretofore unknown, that hits boys at 11 and 6 months. And it's called the BFH, butt-focusing hormone.
Well, the butt-focusing hormone was just a joke for my show. But it was all true how I started getting interested in sex at about 11 and a half, and it happened, boom, just like that, really fast. Pretty soon, there were Playboy magazines under my mattress. Remember, this was 4 decades before sex-starved teenage boys had ready access to online porno. Hooray for Hugh Hefner. Here's how I explained my very unsure sexual development over the next few years.
Then things got a little more gutsy when I started getting 14, 15, 16, and this is the senior ball. We went home after this thing, and we did park, and I found my hand doing this, and she would just push it away. You know, that's what they did in those days. They push away, because if you let him cop a feel, that's going to lead to pregnancy, heroin, and the end of your life. We're really clear about that. So you push it away. In today's world, as I look at the movies, when they're going to have sex, they knock over the furniture, taking their clothes off. I mean, it's very different period of time. So I felt so bad about that, I called her up the next day and apologized. We were so uptight in the 50s. Think about this. Lenny Bruce was fighting constantly because he'd say dirty words in his stand-up comedy routine. Remember Howell, City Lights published this book, Howell, 6 months fighting in the courts about it. Lady Chatterley's Lover. The Puritans had made this country so tight sexually, and it was like in the 50s and the 60s, it was starting to open up. My mom even said, even though she'd been reading Dr. Spock, she said, Rick, don't have sex too soon. It'll give you something to look forward to. I thought she was so full of shit because I said, I think I'll do it now and then I'll look forward to tomorrow. This is our high school reunion. This is our 60th reunion. There's about 100 of us there, and there were 600 in our class. And when we first started doing these reunions, I was just finishing my doctorate and all about research. And so I said, well, I think I'm going to do a survey. So we did this big 5-6-page survey. Not just about who's your spouse and what do you do. It was, you know, serious stuff. Like, you know, if you had a drinking problem, do you have drugs issues? What about, you know, the death of your parents and your children and blah, blah. So we got into some deep stuff. And the last question on this survey was, were you a virgin when you graduated from Berkeley High? A whopping 80% said yes. But then people would write to me, even though it was anonymous, and they told me some horrible stories. So one girl said, I was so uptight I had to be drunk and I was in the back seat of a 55 Chevy and I hardly remember it. Another said, he got us some cheap motel. There was blood all over the sheets. I was terrified. I had no idea what was happening. That was typical. That's the way it was in those days.
More than 100 people returned that first anonymous survey at our 20-year reunion. The virginity question got some extraordinary responses. Yes, I was too scared not to be. Wasn't everybody a virgin in 57? I always took the body as a gift from God. Marriage is the sacred place where you give your body to Christ and your spouse. Yes, I was a virgin in 57, but don't ask between marriages. I can't count that eye. I have not been a virgin since the age of 15 and a half. I still remember the date, the time, the place, and of course the person. So it must have been a momentous occasion. Actually, it was unintentional, accidental, stupid, and also inevitable now that I think about it. Hey, sex is a beautiful thing. What are you doing later? While these answers ranged from light and funny to poignant and sad, one that stood out for me was from a lesbian in our class. She described the pain of being gay and in the closet in the 1950s. Looking back at high school, she reflected what life was like for her. High school was the worst time of my life. For anyone who was different from the white, middle-class, English-speaking, able-bodied, heterosexual ideal, it was a painful and alienating time. My group was invisible.
80% confessed to being virgins. But, you know, you didn't want anybody to know that. I mean, I had a rubber in my wallet. And by the way, let's stop calling these things condoms. What is that crap? Condoms is what you have in San Francisco in a high office building. You know, you have a little condom. Well, that's, no, listen, anyway. So let's just call them rubbers. They're rubbers. Because I remember I wanted one in my wallet just in case. And I carried it for so long in my wallet, you could see the little circle on the wallet like that. And it finally turned to dust. I mean, nothing happened with that. And I remember when I went to get my rubbers, you know, my Trojans. And I went into the drugstore, and you wouldn't believe it. These younger folks wouldn't believe it. But you couldn't even sell condoms or rubbers out there. There was under the counter, and the pharmacist had to give it to you. Nowadays, you can buy them anywhere. And so I went into the drugstore, and here behind the counter is the most beautiful girl in our class who was also the mayor's daughter. I said, is the pharmacist around? No, he's gone to lunch. Can I help you? Okay, let's see. Okay, I want some toothpaste, a comb, Sports Illustrated, and three Trojans. She said, what? Trojan? And her face just turned ashen gray, and she immediately lost all respect for me, I'm sure. But that was my first trying to get into this sexual stuff by carrying a rubber around with me. And one of the things that happened is when we had this reunion, there was a cocktail party before we had dinner. And one of my old girlfriends was here, and I was telling her about feeling like I was the only virgin at Berklee High School, and it was so hard, I wanted to get rid of this virginity thing, which I called a pre-existing condition. I said, you know, what happens when you lose your virginity? Is it like, where does it go? I mean, it's like your car keys, you know, can you find it again? I figured it's more like going to Europe, you know. It's like, have you been to Europe? You haven't been to Europe? You're still a virgin? And then you come back from Europe, so I've been to Europe. I'm not a virgin. So I was talking to this girl about how hard it was, and she looked at me and she said, in kind of a disgusted, she said, Rick, you never asked. Never asked? Because all I had to do is ask? Boy, if I went back to high school, a lot of things would be different.
In 1959, I joined a college fraternity. My sexual naivete and lack of experience caused me a huge amount of embarrassment during our initiation. Toward the end of Hell Week, the fraternity member who was in charge of this torturous mess pulled me out of the line and stood with his face about 2 inches in front of my face, like they do in the Marine Corps, and screamed as loud as he could, "So, Gilbert, why don't you tell us, Gilbert, are you a virgin?" Lying, I shouted back, "No, sir!" At which point he said, "Well, Gilbert, why don't you tell us about it?" Trying to make it up as I went along, I said, "Well, sir, it was in the back of a 55 Chevy." Now, at this point, I was free-forming it, drawing heavily on the experience of a friend of mine who'd had sex earlier than the rest of us at age 16. He told us all about it. So, his story became my story. And then, of course, I mixed in some Mickey Spillane, you know, her heaving breasts and my fingers fumbled with the buttons on her blouse. It was all very steamy. When it was all done, the sadistic drill sergeant screamed at me and everyone else in the room, "Gilbert, we don't believe you! You're bullshitting us!" Unfortunately, he was right. Actually, I don't think I fooled anyone. It wasn't until the following summer at age 19 when a decent, sweet girl from our class helped me to lose that horrible pre-existing condition called virginity.
Now, I graduated from college, and I knew I didn't want to do what my father did. My father was in the insurance business, and our dining room, our dinner table, had some of the most boring stuff. We talked about actuarial tables, liability, indemnity, claims adjuster, casualty. Jesus, God, I thought this was excruciatingly boring. So the one thing I didn't want to do was do what he did. And he wore this Brooks Brothers suit and a hat with a little feather in it and all that stuff. So I wanted something exciting to do. And I saw this ad for the Public Health Service, United States Public Health Service. But okay, I think I'll try that. What the ad was for was a venereal disease epidemiologist.
My new job with the Public Health Service in around 1963 marks the beginning of what I call phase two of my own sexual development. But it wasn't just me. A lot was happening around the country to loosen up our sexual mores, as we'll see shortly.
So I got this job, and I was a federal employee, but I worked at the Berklee City Health Department. Probably the most interesting part of all of this was I got to work with the doctor, because I would do these interviews. You see, this was going on nationwide. There was an epidemic of gonorrhea and syphilis. And so people like me were in health departments nationwide, and my job was to interview somebody that came in with, let's say, gonorrhea, and I had to find out who they'd been sleeping with, because the guy would be symptomatic. He would hurt like hell when he peed, and he'd have pus coming out of the end of his penis. But the female that he'd been partners with had no symptoms. Or if it had been a gay relationship, there's no anal symptoms either, right? So my job was to interview these people. And in our training, it was amazing. They said, what you want to do is set up an atmosphere of acceptance. And you want people to feel free to tell you everything. And so we used to do things like this. So let's take this one guy, Bob, we'll call him. 20 years old, goes to Cal, he's a sophomore. He comes in, he has gonorrhea. So I'm interviewing him, And I said, as they told me to do in my training, they said, okay, Bob, how many sex partners have you had in the last year? Would you say it's 150, 200, what, right about there? And you go, what? No, I mean, I have my girlfriend and this gal at the party. And I said, no, Bob, I mean everybody. You know, the truck stops, the gay bars, the whores, you know, everything, include everybody. No, just the girl at the party. But sometimes you actually would find, I remember I interviewed this one guy, he was very active sexually, gay guy, he lived in San Francisco, and he'd had syphilis twice. And he really took this seriously, and he would keep track of everybody. And I remember interviewing him in his apartment, very nice apartment. We're sitting at this round table, and he's giving me tea. We're having tea as I'm doing my interview. He pulls out a card file with 150 names. I said to him, how many have you had? 150? He said, yeah, that's about right. I mean, this guy'd go out every night. But he was responsible, and he'd write down their names just in case. So for me to be working in the VD department, it was a eye-popping, jaw-dropping. I mean, I was seeing a freer side of sexuality.
Now, the Berkeley City Health Department was about two blocks away from Berkeley High School, a huge urban high school with over 3,000 students. As a public health outreach into the community, one of our goals was to offer seminars to the high school students about the dangers of venereal disease and where they needed to come for treatment if, in fact, they had any symptoms. Our goal was to give them the information, but also let them know that when they came to the health department, everything would be handled strictly confidentially. We told them that in the event that they got venereal disease, they could get treatment from the health department by California law without their parents being notified. The whole idea was respect confidentiality and to be non-judgmental. But the funniest thing that happened in all of my work in public health was when we presented a series of 9 seminars given to the boys and girls in their PE classes. The clinic doctor, the nurse, and myself presented each of these 45-minute seminars to groups of 300 to 400 students. The football coach, who'd been helping us coordinate all of these sessions, sat in the back with each of our presentations. He seemed quite conservative, and I could tell from the beginning that he didn't much approve of any of this. Venereal disease? Public health? Confidential treatment? Now, we recorded each of these sessions so that we could improve our presentations. At the end of the last session of our 9 presentations, the coach got up to say a few words. He couldn't contain himself anymore. He announced to the 300 students that, well, you've heard from all of these public health people. Now I want to say a few words. I thought, oh boy, this is going to be ripe. They told us about what causes VD and how to treat it. And then he got all huffy and puffed out his chest and he said, well, I don't know about any of that, but I'll tell you this. If you ask me, God put VD on this earth to punish sinners. Well, there went our non-judgmental approach to it all. We took the tape back to the health department and played it for the 30 people in the department, and you could have heard the laughter 2 blocks away. While I was expanding my own knowledge of sexuality in the health department, the country was also moving ahead and loosening up considerably. The country's puritanical standards were being challenged in the courts. Lenny Bruce, in the years 1964 to 66, was in court all the time, being arrested for using profanity in his nightclub shows. Allen Ginsberg's book, Howl, was also being challenged in the courts for profanity, as was Lady Chatterley's Lover. In 1964, the Supreme Court handed down a landmark decision on what constitutes obscenity and pornography. This brought some clarity to the issue and also loosened it up a bit. The early 1960s also saw the wide use of the birth control pill and another Supreme Court decision in 1965 that made it legal for married couples to use birth control. And in 1972, the court made it legal for unmarried couples to use birth control. Can you believe that? Then in 1973, the court ruled that no states could deny a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy through abortion. Clearly, things were changing in all directions. I arbitrarily mark the beginning of phase 3 of my own sexuality and my own sexual development with the birth of our daughter, Katie McGlynn Gilbert, in 1991. I do this because she's grown up in a world that is sexually light years beyond what it was like for us in the 1950s. Here's how I explained it in a live show.
I continued with my sexual education, starting out from almost ground zero. And soon, though, I knew enough that I was teaching college classes in sex ed. I was teaching a class at San Francisco State University called The Psychology of Human Sexuality. And in this class, there was a beautiful young woman named Mary McGlynn. Now, this was a 6-week class, so if anything was going to happen pretty fast. And I thought there was quite a bit of flirting going on between the two of us. And at the end of the class, when the grades had been turned in and the class was over, I asked her out to dinner. And over dinner, I said, Mary, that was the theory part. Now we're going to do the hands-on part of the class. So we dated for a few years. We lived together for a few years. We finally got married. And we had this kid named Katie McGlynn Gilbert. Now, the big deal here about having this kid, it could have been a boy or a girl, didn't matter to me. I did not want this kid to grow up feeling so inhibited and so uptight about sex. So right from the beginning, lots of, you know, bathroom, open doors, you know, nudity, fine. We're going to be really open and progressive and liberal about all of this. And Katie, she seemed to figure this out pretty quickly. I mean, she got the message. And I remember one night, she was 3 years old, and I'm in bed with her, and I'm reading her a nighttime story called Clifford the Big Red Dog. So we're reading. Mary, who'd been out to a meeting, comes in about 8 o'clock, pokes her head in the door. Hi, Mommy! Daddy and I are having sex! Mary says, well, not exactly, honey, and don't say anything like that at school, okay? And Katie just was on this from the beginning, and she was all involved with this stuff. And by the time she got to high school, she was reading Masters and Johnson, the Kinsey Report. She even did a science project where she did a survey of her fellow students about their attitudes and experiences with sex. So imagine, like 11th grade. So she's really into it. And then, when she was getting about the age when she thought she would become sexually active herself, she said to me, so, Dad, how old were you when you first had sex? Now, I don't know how many in this room are parents or if your kids ever ask you that. But you see, I'm Mr. Open, of course, so I have to deal with this. I said, well, honey, I'm a little chagrined. I was 19 years old. Her response is, great, I'm 17. I'm 2 years ahead of you. So she was ready. She went to Kaiser and she had a GYN exam. She got birth control. And she even told me the night that she thought it was going to happen. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me because of the trust. And all the stuff I'd been working on to kind of make it open seemed to have been working. And she confided in me. And she came home about 10 o'clock at night with a bunch of flowers in her arms. And I looked at her and I said, well, did it happen? She said, yes, big smile. I gave her a high five. I said, yes, you're no longer a virgin. Yeah, woo! Now I'll tell you, nothing like that ever happened in the 50s. And I don't even think it happens much now. But I felt so good about having that sense of communication and trust. She continued in her journey of sexuality. It was amazing. She started to meet prostitutes. She met strippers. She met sex educators. She even was an assistant at a class at Santa Clara University that taught sex to therapists. So she was getting more and more into this stuff. She brought some strippers over to our house. Let me tell you, they're nice people. I mean, they were great.
A key part of this story is when Katie went to work for Good Vibrations, a store that sells sex toys. She tells several stories of reaching out to very nervous customers. I am so proud of the empathy that she expresses for these people who are struggling with their own sexuality. During my coming of age in the 50s and 60s, nothing like good vibrations would have been tolerated. In today's world, they make life much better for so many people because things are now so much more open. Update. When I did this sketch several years ago, she was still working at Good Vibrations. Today she is at San Francisco State finishing up her degree in psychology.
Well, today, Katie works in a store where they sell sex toys. And I will tell you that she is awfully good in this job. She got promoted to assistant store manager, but it's what she does with the customers that amazes me. Because you can imagine you go into a store with sex toys, and if you're carrying stuff like I was from childhood in the 50s, this is pretty intimidating. And I have heard stories of how she makes people feel good and draws them out and makes them comfortable. She told me a story a couple of months ago. This woman, about 60, came to the front door and she stood there. And Katie went up to her and the woman said, "I've been circling the block for 3 days. I'm so frightened to come here." Katie reaches out and touches her shoulder and says, "I am so proud of you. You have taken the first step to having the rest of your sexual life be very satisfying to you. You have come to the right place. Congratulations." And this woman began bawling. Katie took her to the back room. They had a session, 20 minutes or so talking. The woman kind of composed herself, and then Katie took her around by the arm. They went around and they looked at all the stuff, and here were the dildos and the vibrators and the lubricants and S&M, and you got leather and you got handcuffs and having it all. And this woman is just going, you know? And Katie said, "A little overwhelming, huh?" "Yeah." But Katie told me that she thought the woman on that day was going through some kind of a life transformation. The woman bought a few things, and when she left, she stood at the door and she hugged Katie tight and she said, "Thank you. Today you've changed my life."
I've been working for a very pro-female, pro-education, very clean environment, adult boutique. I wanted to tell you a few stories that are moving and that are incredible stories from the work that I've been doing. These three older women came in, between 60 and 70 years old. And I had actually known one of them from my previous job, so we hit it off. You know, she felt very comfortable. And she said, "My friend is looking for something because her husband has been out of town for the past year, and he's coming back to see her. They've never used sex toys before, so why don't you go help her out?" So I went up to her, and I was talking to her, and I said, "Well, let's get you started on something, you know, kind of simple. Do you know if you want a clitoral stimulator or a G-spot stimulator?" And she's looking at me like she has no idea what I'm talking about. And she said, "I'm new to this." And I said, "Okay, well, internal or external use?" And she was like, "What would be the benefit?" She had no idea what the G-spot was, no idea like how she could use a clit stimulator during sex. So I had to start from, it was like teaching a, you know, middle schooler about their body. And I had to tell her, "Okay, well, the G-spot is located between 1/2 inch and 2 inches inside the body towards the belly button. It's really great if you want to kind of figure out where that is." And she like lit up like the thought of, "Oh, great, there's more that I can do to experience a different kind of orgasm. And there's more that I've never even thought about. My husband is, you know, we're squares. Like, we have never experienced anything pretty much other than missionary sex. Like, this toy is, I don't even know what to get because it might scare him." So I showed her this little tiny finger vibrator that would go right in between here. It would be easy to use during sex. And I was like, well, let's look at lube. And she was like, oh, well, I need lube. Like, that's not something that I create anymore. So we have all these different kinds of lube. And we were laughing and having a great time. And when we were checking out, it was like, she was giddy. Like, oh, wow. For the first time, I feel like I can experiment again. I feel like I'm, you know, in high school again. I'm so late to the game. I would have never thought at my age I could still do this. And this is my first time being in a sex shop. And you guys made me feel so comfortable and like I could ask anything and like not ashamed that I don't know my own body. And it was really cool to see this 65-year-old woman just excited to go have sex again with her husband. So I had this couple come in, a very young couple, probably in their early 20s. They sort of looked middle class, maybe, definitely not people that I would have assumed had a lot of education. The girl was being very, very ditzy, like, ha 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 ha, oh, like, look at this big dick, blah, 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 ah, and like kind of showing off for her date. Who was laughing along with it. And I went over and I said, well, do you need help finding anything? Do you have any questions? And she said, yeah, I've used a bullet before, which is a very tiny little vibrator just for your clitoris. Very straightforward and simple. And she said, that was amazing, but or else I've never really used a sex toy before. And I said, okay, cool. And she said, which one's your best one? And that always kind of floors me when people ask me that, because there's no way for me to be able to tell you which one's the best one. We're all different. And I could feel that she was getting frustrated. Like, I don't know, just tell me like what to get. Tell me what I need to do. And I was talking to her about the G-spot. She didn't know. You know, that seems to be a common thing. People don't know. They think that it's fake. It's proven that it's in your anatomy. It is there. And then she mentioned that they were both, her and her date, were both going to Stanford. And he was studying to be a doctor. And she was almost done getting her law degree. And that just shocked me, because they were coming across so different than what I would have expected that to be. And since we're trained in sex education, we actually get more training than the average doctor about sexual health. So he didn't know a lot of things, she didn't know a lot of things. She was getting very frustrated, and her mood was definitely changing from like ditzy and fun to like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I said, oh, well, you're a law student, like you must really, really comprehend things on paper. Like, and she said, yeah, I mean, give me like a stack of law papers and I'll get through that in a few days. But ask me to look at my own body and I have no idea what to do. I've never even looked at my own vagina. And I mean, like, we were both getting a little bit emotional, and I was like, okay, well, you obviously comprehend things better through, you know, stuff that you can read and stuff that you can understand and think about. Like, let me show you to the books. And I recommended Sex for One by Betty Dodson, which is, I told her, I read this in high school, and it changed my life. It changed the way that I thought about masturbation. It changed the way I thought about my own body. And it was just, I read it 4 times. It was an amazing, amazing tool to have when I was 14. And she said, you've been studying this stuff since you were 14? I said, well, actually, I've been very interested in sex education since middle school. And she said, I've never even thought about it. Like, I would never be able to tell you anything about sex. I could recite laws to you like no other, but sex is so scary. So I said, sex for one, for sure. And then there's this other one called I Heart Female Orgasms. It has pictures. It's written by a couple that it's kind of similar. She didn't really know that much. She got diagnosed with breast cancer, and then she said, fuck, my life is coming to an end, and I don't know anything about my sexual self. And so her and her husband started experimenting and learning more, and then they wrote this really great book that's a really great read. It's funny. It has pictures. It talks about all different types of stuff. And so she bought those two books. She said, I'll be through these in a week, and when I come back, I want you to help me. I feel completely connected and like changed by this. The fact that you understood that I learn differently and I need to read about it. And you recommended me these books that you personally were changed by. Like, I want to come back and get my vibrator from you. And I went around the counter and I gave her a very tearful hug. We've both embraced, and it was like the first time that I've never thought of myself as smart. And sex education is always like brushed under the rug. I have all this information to give and people are dying to hear it. They need to hear it. And they want to hear it, and they know nothing about it. And she's a law student, and she was thanking me and telling me how smart I was. And it was very emotional. And I went home, and I thought about it a lot. I told my family about it, and I'm getting emotional now. I got emotional then. For the first time, I felt smart and like I had something to offer.
We as individuals, and we as a nation, have loosened up around sexuality considerably. This creates, I would hope, less pain for people and perhaps even more pleasure. Without question, there have been excesses in this liberation. Some of the sexual pornography that we see on the internet, and even in stage shows, can stretch our tolerance. At least, it stretches mine. Even television commercials talk about boner problems, menstrual disorders, and constipation. Remember that in the 1950s, when I was growing up, in movies or on TV, if you showed a married couple in the bedroom, they had to be in separate beds, never in the same bed. Elvis Presley appearing on Ed Sullivan shaking his hips around created such an uproar, it's reverberated through the decades. I guess, though, that all of this is the price we pay for less repression and more openness. The progress that we've made during the course of my lifetime, as I've outlined in my three phases of sexuality, has been simply amazing. For example, in 2015, the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage. Stunning! Who'd have thunk it? So I think we have a lot to celebrate. Today, in many places, if someone comes out as gay, it just elicits a shrug of the shoulders. So what? Now that is progress. But it does make me feel regret for my lesbian friend and so many like her from high school that had to endure the pain of the 50s. We're moving ahead. In chapter 10, we dive right into the second topic that Connie Gilbert said never to talk about, religion.